One day, I passed a church advertisement and was driven to stop and look at it twice. It was a photograph of a man in climbing equipment, standing in sunlight on the pinnacle of a mountain. I was surprised, almost affronted by the caption, "Is there more to life than this?" I wasn't entirely sure there was, nor ought to be. But I pondered it all the same. It had a profound effect on me, though not quite the one it intended. Whenever I thought of it, I felt myself drawing to the threshold of a revelation, a realization so large that it was difficult to see its full extent. Every day, I leave the house and walk my children to school. They are 5 and 6. They go to school and come back again, go and come back, go and come back. They are happy enough to do it, though they retain a certain neutrality, as though they have been promised an explanation and are patiently waiting for it to be given. On New Year's Eve, we go to a party on Dartmoor. In the morning, I wake in an unfamiliar bedroom and look through the window at the moor, veiled with rain. The shrouded hills are desolate. They seem to extend on and on, into an indistinct kind of infinity. After breakfast, the women sit on sofas, talking. Their children dart in and out. Sometimes they reach out and catch one, to hold its squirming body and stroke its bright, fine hair. Their female forms are fixed and sculptural. Though the children squirm, they are glad to be held by something so firm. The women are both shelter and shrine. They offer, and at the same time they ask. They have agreed to stay still. It is the children who choose between security and risk. It's important that they choose correctly. They mustn't cling to their mothers, nor must they forget to swim past, close enough to be caught. In time, we decided to leave Bristol and move elsewhere. Our friends were sorry to see us go, yet I had a terror of my own, which was the fear of knowing something in its entirety. To seek held no particular fear for me. It was to find and to know, and to come to the end of knowing that I shrank from. Go we must, go we would. But where? In the novels I read, people were forever disappearing off to Italy at a moment's notice, to wait out unpropitious seasons of life in warm and cultured surroundings. It was a cure for everything. Love, disappointment, stupidity, strange vaporous maladies of the lungs. And for disenchantment too, perhaps, for claustrophobia and boredom, and for a hunger that seemed to gnaw at the very ligaments of my soul, whose cause was as hidden from me as were the means of its satisfaction. We decided to go to Italy, though not forever. 3 months, a season, was as much of the future as we cared to see. Perhaps we would return to England. Perhaps we would not. We put the house on the market and took the children out of their school. To this place, at least, we were never coming back. The boat we are taking to France leaves from Newhaven, an hour from my parents-in-law's house. We get up while it is still dark, an April darkness. Damp, suggestive, faintly hopeful. It is 4:30. We prise the children from their beds, stagger around, thick-tongued and white-faced. We drive across the Sussex Downs to Newhaven. Rounding the bend, we see our boat, black plumes of smoke pouring from its funnels, monolithic against the miniature scale of the muddy harbour. We move slowly forward to where the boat stands, shuddering vastly in the water, its doors standing open, its men beckoning us in. Soon we are barreling towards Paris. In the back of the car, we have clothes, books, a guitar, a box of toys, tennis rackets, a thermos flask, a large Italian dictionary. By afternoon the following day, we are down in the Rhone Valley. Lyon lies behind us. The temperature gauge is singing like a canary. Then all at once we are out with the mineral blue Mediterranean sparkling below us and the white Palladian vista of settlements frilled with surf of Cannes and Antibes and San Rafael stretching all along the hazy shoreline of the Côte d'Azur. We have travelled from one sea to another, from one world to another. Suddenly there are palm trees on the roadside and warm maritime breezes and a feeling of liberty, of an almost physical unburdening. We have closed the door on England as one would close the door on a dark and cluttered house and walk out into the sun. In the late afternoon, we arrive at Cap Ferrat. We are staying here on the threshold of Italy. Tomorrow, we will cross over. The Garfagnana is cloaked in cloud. The melancholy hills of Barja make giant shapes that vanish upwards into mist. We came here over the White Apuan Mountains, leaving behind the rose-coloured light of the coast, the Belle Epoque charm of Santa Margherita and Portofino, up and up into regions of dazzling ferocity, where we wound among deathly white peaks, scarred with marble quarries, along glittering chasms where the road fell away into nothingness, and we clung to our seats in terror. We are staying for a few days in a little house on the side of a hill, where at night it rains and rains, and the clouds hang all day in the valley. It is not somehow as we expected it to be. It is as if we have entered a cul-de-sac at great speed. After the exhilaration of escape, we find that we are still here, unaltered. But we did not come here to find ourselves. We came for something we are able to identify only by its absence. We grow bad-tempered. What exactly are we meant to do? We go for walks. We go to Barja. On the fourth day, we decide to go to Lucca. We board the train and pass along the Serchio Valley, among gentle green perspectives of hills and distant mountains. I feel that something new is disclosing itself, something to do with time. We are free. No one is expecting us. Lucca stands in an unbroken circle of gigantic walls. They are 40 or 50 feet high, dark and so thick that over time they have become a land formation. A strange circular isthmus with lawns and trees and paths on the top. Outside them, the city has spread its clutter, its traffic and car parks and residential suburbs. Within, in the old town, an atmosphere of unusual refinement prevails. Every infelicitous speck of modernity has been sieved out. We hire bicycles, the accepted means of transportation here, and go up to the ramparts, where a breeze rustles the great skirts of the trees, and the laid-out paths and lawns, so strangely elevated, recede down their long curving perspectives. It is 4 kilometres all the way round the town. We see its bell towers and palaces, its piazzas and churches, the Guinigi Tower with its mysterious forested top, all seeming to turn like a jewelled mechanical city, pirouetting on a music box. In the afternoon we wander the paved streets. There are people here, people in the churches and the cafes, up the towers and on the streets. They seem perfectly satisfied with all this magnificence. They seem content. They look at the Roman remains and the Palazzo Pretorio. What is it to them, I wonder, this place whose lairs reach down so strangely, so intricately into time like a crevasse into the frozen mystery of a glacier? What in a personal sense does it signify? They come to marvel at the sublimity and passion that human beings were once capable of. I wonder why its monuments fail to shake them out of their composure. Do they not want to be passionate themselves and sublime? Why do they care so much for it, with their video cameras and guidebooks and long lenses, with their money belts and sensible shoes, when it cares so little for them? In the Piazza San Martino is the Duomo. Inside, there is a painting by Tintoretto of the Last Supper. It is small, or perhaps it is merely crowded, for it contains many figures. The figure of Jesus at the far end of the table is the painting's furthest and smallest point, as though to express the remoteness of the conceptual, of self-sacrifice. In a busy room where a woman reclines breastfeeding her baby in the foreground, and men are leaning across the table to talk, eager living men with brown skin and muscular arms, talking and gesticulating around a table laden with food and wine. The two men at the nearest end of the table are distinctively dressed. One wears a purple tailored coat, and the other has the sleeves of his shirt rolled up to the biceps. They are talking together. They possess a great reality, the reality of the living moment, of the chunks of bread and the half-drunk glasses of wine, and the woman who watches their conversation instead of the baby at her breast. I look at this painting for a long time. I try to understand it. I try to understand the difference between the people close to Jesus at the far end of the table and the people down at this end, close to us. The closer they are to us, the less attention they pay him. Yet it's more beautiful down here. It is richer and more alive. At the other end, Jesus bends to put bread in the bearded mouth of Peter, and Peter ardently clasps his hands. That, too, is a moment of life in this painted scene. I don't doubt that Tintoretto believed it himself, but the reality of the man in the purple coat, whose hand rests on a fallen keg of wine, is too powerful. Perception is stronger than belief, at least for an artist, who sees such grandeur in ordinary things. In this, it is the artist who is God. And it's a strange kind of proof we seek from him, we who are so troubled by our own mortality, who know we will all eat a last supper of our own. We want the measure of the grandeur taken. We want to know that life was indeed what it seemed to be. On the train home, we find our guidebook in a bag and discover that we have seen virtually nothing of the glories of Lucca, neither the National Museum nor the Villa Guinigi. Later, we will learn to fillet an Italian city of its artworks with the ruthless efficiency of an English aristocrat deboning a Dover sole. We do not know yet the hunger that will take us in its grip, but for now, we are perfectly satisfied. Like all the other tourists who daily circumnavigate Lucca's terrifying walls, we are quite content. In a few days, we are going south, to the house that will be our home until the summer comes.